Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I saw my teacher give Dharma talks when he was sick many times, but I don't remember when I've done it, so let's see what happens. So I'm sick probably because I've been spending a lot of time with my grandchildren in the last few weeks. I have four grandchildren, and the three oldest live in California. So I flew down to Fresno for my grandson's high school graduation. And then I drove all the way back to Portland with them, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds. That alone could make you sick. The nutrition alone could make you sick. They're really young for their age, and they've grown up in a lot of chaos. They're in a big family with multiple step relatives, a shifting group of unstable adults, not all related. And they've always lived in near poverty. I think my grandson's moved 15 times in 18 years. And they've had really limited exposure to other ways of life, except from their grandfather and me. So because of that, I found myself really in a parental role with them rather than a grandmotherly role. I've been really the only source of discipline and structure, even from a distance. So we've been the ones that are monitoring nutrition and following the grades and teaching rules of behavior. We're the only ones modeling things like going outdoors into the wilderness or reading for pleasure and an empathy for others. But now they're approaching adulthood, and I'm really working on opening my hands and letting go of this parental role and moving into the grandmotherly role. And Keizan, one of our founding ancestors, often spoke of Sanshin, the three minds of practice. Daishin is magnanimous mind, which is calm and steady acceptance and equanimity. It's the all-inclusive view of no difference. And Kishin, which is joyful mind, which is finding delight in difficulty and enjoying the rich experience we have in difficulty and in samsara, being able to be present in a struggle while being undisturbed. And then finally, Roshin, which is grandmotherly mind. The characters for Roshin mean old woman heart. And it's the mind that takes joy in watching others mature and encouraging others to grow and develop. So this has been leading me to think about the roles and archetypes that we occupy in our lives, and especially in relationship to each other and to our practice. So when I first started practicing, I was a young adult in my 20s, my early 20s, and I didn't believe in archetypes as a driver for behavior. Of course, now I realize that it's part of the archetype of the young adult to refuse to believe that one is conditioned. Youth really resents the idea of programmed responses and ritualized responses. So any talk of archetypes in practice really irritated me. If it irritates you today, I offer you that. I remember thinking, how could anyone say that I acted out of a programmed response or a script? How could you say that I was revisiting old experience? I was an adult. Now, as a real adult and an older adult, I do believe in archetypes, and I really welcome the idea. I see that we embody roles and fulfill them for each other all the time, and that not only is this real, but it's crucial that we need archetypes in our lives and we need to confront them. Because every one of us feels like an imposter on the inside. At some point, maybe once a day, maybe once a week, there's a point where we think, how do people do this? How do grown-ups learn how to do this? As we're going through our adult life and doing adult tasks, there's a sense of thinking everybody else knows how. And that's because we all have unfinished developmental tasks. Nobody gets it all done in childhood. So when we get into adulthood, we may have a particular task like learning to express our emotions, or being willing to take risks, or being able to take on responsibility, or being able to trust in intimacy. These are developmental tasks that most of us don't entirely finish in childhood. So the Buddha did use archetypes often, in a fairly gentle way, but he used this concept all the time. He often addressed his audience by their roles. And in ancient India, of course, a very stratified society in which people were deeply constrained by roles they were born into, this made sense. And Buddhism was radical in part because it took people outside of this system. They stepped outside their given roles and took on a completely different role that was not dictated by society. But the Buddha was speaking, we need to remember that he wasn't just speaking to his monks, he was often speaking to large groups of people that were still in that system. So he was speaking to the vast majority of people who couldn't step out of their role, who lived inside these tight containers. So his guidance often goes to pairs of people, parent and child, teacher and student, husband and wife. He says, friends and companions, servants and masters, and then he would talk to the ministry and the Sangha as a pair. Now, I think that sooner or later, most of us take on all these roles at some point. And I would add a few. I would add hero and villain, healer and patient, and renunciate and householder. And if anyone has more pairs, I'd love to hear them later. We may spend only a brief time in each of these roles, and it may be related to a very specific relationship at a particular time, but I think sooner or later these all arise for us, sometimes over and over. And as we notice these roles rising in our life, I think we have to remind ourselves to be spontaneous within them. We shouldn't concretize archetypes. I don't think they're really joke material. That we shouldn't act out little scripts with a wink and a nod. And it's very serious stuff. To suddenly find yourself as a child again in relationship to another person who's standing as a parent is a very serious time in your life. And it's a very fruitful time and a risky time. To be suddenly realize that you're a healer to another person without asking to be that, or that you are suddenly a wholly vulnerable patient and seeing another person as a healer, these are serious moments. So when we make them concrete and joke about them or act out scripts, we can create dysfunctional relationships. Now, I don't want to go down this road too far, but of such dysfunction are many marriages and families made. To concretize roles in a relationship can create karma that spills over generations. People grow up with these rigid and fixed ideas about who they are in relationship to other people. They come to believe that they can and cannot do certain things because at some point they were in this role in which they couldn't. One of the stories that I work a lot with my grandchildren around is, I can't, it won't work. Because that's a story they've heard all their life from their parents. I'm helpless. I have no power. So as they get older, it becomes a more fixed idea and becomes much harder for them to release. So when you wake up in an archetypal moment, I think you should own it. You should explore it. Give it life. Let it act you out rather than acting it out. Much as we may resent those moments, I certainly resented discovering that I was a child in relationship to my teacher, the parent. But acting it out, allowing it life, was useful. So I'm going to shift gears to a powerful book called Stages of Faith. The subtitle is The Psychology of Human Development and the Quest for Meaning. And it's by a Christian psychologist, James Fowler. Kyogen became enamored of this book many years ago and asked a group of seniors to study it with him. I think it took us about a year to read through this book together. To sum it up, it's the stages of faith are a way of describing our relationship to deep questions of meaning, essentially what archetypes rise in us as we practice a religious or a faith-based path. That it's not, our archetypes don't just rise up in ordinary social relationships, they rise up in relationship to choices we make, and in relation to religion in particular, and that's what he's exploring. So he names six stages of developmental relationship to faith. So this isn't just relationship, it's developmental faith. They give way to each other. The first is intuitive projective, then mythic and literal, synthetic conventional, individuative reflective, conjunctive, and universalizing. Now those first three, and I know those are real buzzy words, but those first three roughly relate to childhood through adolescence. The child is always the primary archetype. It's always where we begin. And we return over and over to the child in our lives, and we return over and over to the child in our practice. We use the phrase beginner's mind in a lot of different ways to refer to this. This phase that is marked by imagination and story and deep faith and trust. So I'm going to go back and forth to the book and read brief things. He says, this is the fantasy-filled, imitative phase in which the child can be powerfully and permanently influenced by examples, moods, actions, and the stories of visible faith of primally related adults. So you come into practice. This is, you could call this the honeymoon phase, I guess. You see something in someone else, and you want that. So we come into practice because we're suffering. And we see people who seem to have equanimity and composure and a kind of peace that we long for. That If we follow this person, this becomes what they call a primally related adult. And we see visible markers of faith in that person and give ourselves over to this possibility, permanently influenced by examples. But this person also has unrestrained and uninhibited thought. So it's a very open, very wide phase. Everything suddenly becomes possible. It's a whole new way to see the world. And at this phase, images and stories are really important. This is when we just start. We want the Dharma. We really want, we want to read. We want to hear the stories. We long for it. We, rituals and symbols are taken at face value. We just accept it. And at the same time, all these things happen that we have no explanation for and can't describe. So part of this, these early phases, is learning a new vocabulary, coming up with the words to explain. I have a fourth grandchild who's not quite three, and we were all with him as well this week, and I was struck by how hard it is for him to tell us what's going on. It's very clear in his head, but he's struggling to find these words. So throughout all these stages, Fowler talks about what he calls the master stories. What is the master story at any given point that explains the pattern in your life and the meaning that you're finding? What is your master story? And those master stories change. So when we went, when I took the teenagers to see the toddler, he was just running around the house in the yard. He's unafraid, he's spontaneous, he's thinking all the time, and he's demanding attention. He had one total meltdown that was just like a textbook tantrum and bouts of hysterical laughter. And, you know, it's amazing how intense his experience of the world is. He kept asking for people to play with him, and he'd read from a book and repeat, and everything, story is life, right? And that's how we so often are when we discover the Dharma. The thought I had for years was, I still believe this, it was like I was hearing a language that I'd heard as a baby and forgotten. I couldn't speak it, I didn't really understand it, but it resonated with such familiarity and I had to relearn it. So one thing Fowler says we need at this point in our practice, and think of when you first walked in this door, that those first months, we need a sponsor, that's his word. A person or community provides affirmation, encouragement, guidance, and models for a person's ongoing growth and development. The sponsor is one who walks with you, one who knows the path and can provide guidance. So, and I've often thought of seniors and juniors as being like trail guides and hikers. You know, you've walked the trail already once, so you know where the rocks are, and you can just kind of say, watch out for that rock. It's not a gigantic gap. It's just a little bit of familiarity so that you can provide guidance. And the sponsor, crucially, has to let the person test things, has to let them learn the vocabulary by themselves. You have to try it out. So I was watching the little one, who's so unconstrained and uninhibited, and the three older ones who are totally, totally locked in, because their master story is that what other people think about you is very, very important. They're older teenagers, and it's one of the most important beliefs they have, is that how they look and how people think about them is the most important thing. So even as they're struggling to separate, they're just deeply attuned to the opinions of others. And that happens too with our practice. As people of practice grow, the stories become less unrestrained, less uninhibited, less imaginative, and more linear in narrative. They become more ritualized, repeated stories. And a sense of one's worth or lack of worth can arise as you test yourself against these new stories. So this is when that personal myth begins. This master story, are you a good person? Are you a bad person? And these master stories can be very hard to release later on. Excuse me. So the child, the new practitioner, grows into a student, which is more like the second and third phase that Fowler talks about, the student. And this is important. For many adults, it becomes a permanent place of equilibrium. A person has an ideology, a more or less consistent clustering of values and beliefs. Differences of outlook with others are experienced as differences in the kind of person. Authority is located in the incumbents of traditional authority roles. So for a person in this stage, it can be very difficult to disagree with authority, or even one's peers, because that would be disagreeing with the belief system. It's very hard to hold a view separate from the community's view, to be the outlier, or to argue with a position the community takes. It's seriously frightening to take the outside position because one is so fearful of losing one's role. And you can be very strongly defensive of the belief system and the dogma at that point and struggle against somebody else who's expressing disagreement. I've often thought about how much harder it can be for us to disagree with each other in this room than outside this room, because the stakes are so high here. And this is what he's talking about. But, like he said, the adult can permanently occupy this place, because to get out of it, you have to question the truths that you've loved and taken as your own, you have to begin to question. You have to develop new affiliations And so there grows a tension between this urge to conform to the belief system and your own inner value and experience. Conflict with authority is required to move forward. I also didn't really want this to be true. I didn't want to get mad at my teacher and angry with my community and disillusioned and disappointed and frustrated with it. It all led to critical reflection on myself and on what I believed and what I had done. And interestingly enough, Fowler calls this the stage of leaving home, which is very much what we call it too, to be a home leaver, to let go of attachments and roles of the past and freely move into new ones as is appropriate. And this is why some people never, in ordinary daily life, some people never get past this phase. They can't quite let go of these old attachments. So he says movement beyond this may never occur or may not occur until late middle age. It's very hard to become a person who's free of the opinions of others. The individual's faith system is conventional in that it is seen as being everybody's faith system or the faith system of the entire community. So what does it mean to say, no, it's wrong, or I don't agree, or my teacher made a mistake, or I don't think I believe that anymore? It's hugely risky to do that. But the only way to really grow as a practitioner is to become completely disillusioned with being a practitioner, with the dogma, with the authority, with the forms, with the community. You have to see through all of the projections that you've put on it. So it's a very dangerous phase, crucial but dangerous, pretty much what you'd expect. We're leaving the ground that we've come to appreciate. And some people leave and never return. Some people leave in their heart, their body keeps showing up, but they're not really connected, and eventually their body stops showing up. And some people walk out, slamming the door behind them. Some people just quietly disappear for a while and then come back. And some people, like me, do their disagreement right out in the open with everybody listening. And it happens in families, and it happens in individuals, and it happens in faiths and faith communities. So when we see this happening, when we see a friend going through this, struggling with disillusionment, arguing with the authority, complaining about the forms, know that it's okay, that it's important, that it's actually growth. And I think we should also remember that it really hurts. It really hurts. Anybody else in the room who's been through it knows what I'm talking about. Please do not forget that transitions from one to the other are often protracted, painful, dislocating, and abortive. Arrests can and do occur. Each stage has its proper time of ascendancy. Where is it? I have my markers all on the wrong pages here. So what happens if we get past this? If you get through this disillusionment and you stay with it and develop new relationships to the archetypes of faith, new relationships to the form and the community, you become someone who has internalized authority. So it becomes much easier to respond naturally to the authority outside you because you have internalized your own authority. You don't have to be defensive anymore or in conflict all the time. You no longer have to be the teenager slamming the door or the adult getting a face tattoo because you have internalized your own authority, and so you don't have to prove anything. And sometimes Fowler makes the point that sometimes we get there by trading parents for a while. So if we're willing to trade as adults to take on another parent, it can help us move through this phase and become an adult on our own. That may often happen in a romantic relationship. As you know, many times in a romantic relationship, one person parents the other a little bit. So you're leaving your family of origin. You're letting friends and lovers fulfill some of your need for authority. But if you keep going, you stop putting authority outside of yourself. Especially as a person of faith, and especially from the Buddhist point of view, it is internal. Moral authority, control over your behavior, responsibility for your actions, everything is internally located. And we own that. Fowler says, in this point, we're hearing anarchic and disturbing inner voices. I love that phrase, because that's one reason a lot of people get stuck. They start to hear anarchic and disturbing inner voices and don't really want to go there. Those are the deep elemental shadow self, the dark parts, karmic conditioning, the things we don't want to own about ourselves. So this disillusionment and disappointment with authority and with belief systems also becomes disappointment and disillusionment with the self and a questioning of one's choices and the path one has been on. Lots of suppressed material arises. So to be an adult in this sense is to demythologize. Fowler says an adult is a person who internalizes and accepts paradox. I don't know how many times I heard Kyogen talk about being willing to accept paradox as a key part of mature practice. Paradoxes only exist because our view is limited. So if we have a sense of a larger view, even when we're in a smaller view, we can accept the fact that what seems to be a paradox is all right. The adult integrates external and internal experience and understands both in many. So James Fowler is a Christian, but listen to this. This is the way he describes the fifth stage. It sees both or the many sides of an issue simultaneously. Conjunctive faith suspects that things are organically related to each other. It attends to the pattern of interrelatedness in things, trying to avoid force-fitting to its own prior mindset. What the mystics call detachment characterizes stage five's willingness to let reality speak its word, regardless of the impact of that word on the self-esteem of the knower. I speak here of an intimacy in knowing that celebrates, reverences, and attends to the wisdom in things as they are. Stage five knows the sacrament of defeat and the reality of irrevocable commitments and acts. Alive to paradox and the truth in apparent contradictions, this stage strives to unify opposites in mind and experience. It generates and maintains vulnerability to the strange truths of those who are other. It's such a dharmic way to describe it. So if we can move through our own disillusionment with the outside faith and system and our internal struggle with our shadow, we can become a person who resolves the fact of this. We can become a person who coheres as a self and thus has less of a need to make another a self and other and is able to see interrelatedness. And this is the phase in which most good teachers should be functioning. So six stages, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a lot of work to get to this point. Zen has a saying, 10 years to be a senior, 20 years to be a teacher, 30 years to be a master. And I think it's more like 40, 50, 60 years. It's a very long process to do all this internal work. This is a phase in which the experience of having been child and student has been integrated in a really clear way, so that one can really open up to that internal master. And that's discovering what's always been true. But and it's one of the master stories you first hear when you first start to practice. Be your own teacher. Be a light unto yourself. It's one of our earliest master stories. But we hear it, we believe it, but we don't feel it for a long, long time. And that's often true of master stories. They are just the stories, and at some point they come to life. So there's a long way between child and adult. Fowler also notes that the teacher, this fifth stage, is the one who knows the master stories, who's learned all the master stories, and understands how they work, sees them at work in other people, understands how archetypes function and how we grow. So a healthy person at this stage can manipulate the symbols for other people. And he also notes, and I think this is excellent, a healthy person at this stage has an ironic understanding of power. And he uses that phrase, ironic understanding. They understand that they have power over others. The irony is that they know that they are also still a child and still developing and still subject to all of these things. So to be healthy, we can't entirely believe our own press. We have to always understand that we are also still growing. How am I on time? Okay. So there's one final stage I'm not going to say very much about. It's the universalizer. Fowler says it is an exceedingly rare stage, that very few human beings ever reach this stage. They are, he calls them, the incarnators and actualizers of the spirit of an inclusive and fulfilled human community. In other words, the Buddha, the masters, the liberators of others. That there may be a few rising at any given time, but that most people never entirely get there. But we may recognize one. We may recognize that story somewhere. So my voice is going to run out pretty soon, so I'm going to stop here. But I want to leave with two questions. One I think I just kind of answered, which is, are we ever finished with our development? But also, how are these not stages of enlightenment? We are warned against that. We are told that there are no stages of enlightenment. So I would want you to think about how phases of development in relationship to the truth are not stages of enlightenment itself. Questions and hopefully mostly comments.
Well, I think this is mostly comment. It occurred to me when you were speaking of finding that internal freedom, which is, I guess, individuation also, but and finding that internal freedom, I thought, well, the funny thing is at that point, you're realizing it's because you find that when you fully feel this, we're not separated. Like, I cannot be who I am without the activity done to me or I do to others, that there's no separating me from others. And that's where I find, that's where that authority comes from. That's where, and then, so, and then that you ended with that in that sixth stage of irony, or fifth, whichever, that irony, it seems, it's like there always, that, I guess, paradox. It's always there. And at each stage you might find that, yeah. You know, what you've been striving for is not what you found.
Right. I think that's well said. You know, he really makes this point about interrelatedness as a key quality of an adult. An understanding of continual interrelatedness. Instead of being locked in a self and seeing others locked in and really being concerned about what happens between you, there's movement and softness there. Terry?
There you are.
Sorry. That was nice of you.
Thank you very much for your talk, and it's very refreshing to hear talking about development, especially in a Zen context. You know, it's hard to know what to say, because during the beginning part of my path, I was very I threw myself into the practice, but I didn't really attend to my own kind of development until later on in my practice. And I'd never heard of this gentleman, but I'm familiar with other stage development models, and I've just found them very useful. But I very much noticed a difference between my waking up and my growing up, and having to attend to both of those. And I really don't know what else to say other than, you know, show my appreciation.
I just invite you to really let it be alive for you, and don't fight whatever you discover yourself to be at that time. Yeah. It's wonderful to return to that child phase, to give yourself over to the belief system and the authority fully and completely, and just surrender to it. That's a great phase to come in and out of. So let it happen. Many of us, we come in with such longing, and then we pull back. And Buddhism talks a lot about doubt, the importance of doubt, which is really great doubt, which is the doubt that questions everything. And there's a whole talk there that I'd love to give. It's not about skepticism. Skepticism holds us back. Skepticism is, I'll give it a try, but not with all of me. Great doubt, we throw everything in there because we have no idea. Everything's up for question. Everything is on the table. But many of us reach that point where we're just kind of skeptical. We're just getting our feet wet. And you'll never, ever fully integrate the practice if you don't take that chance and throw yourself in. So,
thank you very much.
Terry, Shisei? Wait for the mic, Shisei.
Coincidentally, I was dusting off my bookshelf recently. I came across Fowler's book, and it reminded me of that little seminar that Kyogen and you did for us, and that. I don't know, it's just nice to be reminded of that. And, you know, as we grow, as we age anyway, and hopefully develop.
I remember it as a very rich time of study, and when I pulled the book off, it's just, I've got notes all through the margins. I remember being quite taken with that time, so glad you remember it.
Thank you very much for showing up, Jiko. Not feeling well, I really appreciate it. So much of what I learn here and other places, you know, comes in kind of these categorized, numbered lists or orders. And I find that in listening to your talk, at least with this material, it was more of a snow globe kind of moment for me, where, you know, there have been times in my life where that snow globe is really kind of bewildering, and now it seems like I can hold it with a little bit more wonder. But I see myself in all of that in places, you know, and it's a really rich, I think it will be a rich place to, a filter to put through what my experiences are. So thank you for the snow globe.
Right. Yeah, I do not want to get the impression that there's something fixed or rigid about the phases at all. I mean, you're not just a child for a certain period of time and then become a student. we're shifting around all the time, and parts of our life may be very childlike, or in relation to a particular person, we may have a very childlike relationship, while another part of us is really maturing as a teacher. So I think that's part of that irony, is that even as a very mature person, you're aware of these unfinished tasks. And real children and teenagers do this to us all the time. We get this idea that they're immature in a particular way, and then they say some very fantastically sophisticated thing that we're not expecting at all. Or then they say something really young and immature that we're not expecting. And because we're just a very big, complicated bundle of things. Yeah.
You were talking about heroes, and my hero's always been Superman.
He's a good one.
And the other thing I notice is that power, people don't talk about their power. And I don't know, nobody talks about power, but everybody can talk about Superman.
Yeah. Well, Superman didn't talk a whole lot about his power either.
Yeah.
He figured it was pretty visible, right? I think that's a really smart observation, that powerful people don't reference their power very much, if at all. And people in authority who really own their authority do not have to constantly remind people that they're the boss or that they're the authority or that they're in charge, because everybody knows it. There is a kind of, there's an authority that's granted by the organization, and in our system we'd call that rank. It's given by somebody above you. But authority is only granted by the people who are junior to you, because if they're not going to listen, you don't have any power. They don't vote for you, you don't get the office. So a person who's confident in their authority doesn't need to remind people. You're right. And Superman doesn't have to tell anybody. In fact, I think he kind of liked being Clark Kent a lot of the time. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Oh, there's one at the back.
Thank you very much for this talk. I've always had a degree of discomfort with the idea of faith or faith communities, because I think early on I kind of picked up the idea that faith means you believe something that is firm and hardened and defended and immovable in some way. And then I, somewhere along the way, ran across that the idea that the only faith that is important in Buddhism is faith that meditation works if you stick with it. And I found, at least in little tiny fragments, it does. And I don't know. I just want to thank you.
Thanks. Faith and belief and knowing is a whole other talk, so I decided not to go into that very much. I just accepted Fowler's at face value here, but the word faith is very weighted in Buddhism, for sure. Francis Cook has my favorite definition of it, which is that it is a rumor that Buddhist faith is the rumor that something might be true, and it is eventually, after we investigate the rumor, it is replaced by the truth of it. So we eventually, he says, we set aside faith because we just know. Somebody in another tradition would say, well, that is what faith is, and so on. So there's endless semantics to it. I don't get too hung up on it, because I do have faith in the sense that I believe that this works. I believe that this is an expression of truth. So I'm okay with the word. we just have to remember that the difference, the primary difference in faith communities is whether the faith comes from an outside authority or an internal authority. And our key criteria here is that we say that you know this internally. You don't believe it because someone else told you. You discover it for yourself. But we have to begin by hearing somebody else tell us. That's where it starts. So there are, that's literally why he calls it stages of faith. There's a faith when you just believe it because you heard it. Something resonated. You're going to investigate it. And all through those phases of childhood and young adulthood, you're investigating whether it's true. And you're arguing with it. And eventually you internalize it.
Thank you, Chico. Very thought-provoking. I just wanted to mention, you made that distinction about skepticism and doubt. And I have this very clear memory of an event in my practice that kind of was a transition for me. And it had to do with our forms. And I was off for the late summer retreat on the farm, and we were, I can't remember if it was the first morning or not, but we get up, please stand for 9 vows, right? Which had always struck me as a very strange thing that we do here. There's this kind of euphemistic full bows, otherwise known as a prostration. But got up, and I realized I had actually kind of just done this in this natural way. The resistance I'd always felt was to doing that. This is not something we do in this part of the world. That my resistance to that was gone, and it's never returned. And I'm still not sure why we do it, but it doesn't bother me anymore. And so that kind of embedded skepticism about this is nonsense mm-hmm. is gone. And I'm still trying to figure out what it all means. But I'm at least willing to accept the possibility that there's something that I might learn from it.
That's really all you need. And I've often thought that full prostration is fruitful and difficult forms that we have. It's a very useful mirror. I will say, I believe that it was Suzuki who said when he first came to the United States, he brought a form which was 3 bows. And after spending a little time here, he said, I think because you're Americans, you should do 9. Somehow we shifted from 3 to 9. He just felt like it would be good for us to keep doing that practice. So it's one of our brightest mirrors. So keep studying it. Yeah.
Thank you.
One more last one. I guess 2 quick ones, and then we'll stop. So Eric, and then back there.
Thanks for your talk, Chico. I really liked having anchor points or somebody else's frame of reference to explain things going on in my life, so that was very helpful. And what I was reflecting on is that several years ago I started a seminary, and I'm not entirely sure why I wanted to just get more involved, and immediately became very reactive to the whole thing, which reached a peak studying the Lotus Sutra. And I came in the class one time, and Jyoshin very thoughtfully said, how is this for all of you? And I stepped right up and I said, this is a bunch of crap. And pretty much stunned and offended everybody in class. But I realize, you know, using your framework, that that is the test, the testing, the tearing down, the making it my own. And although I am not a big fan of Buddhist literature for a variety of reasons, it has taught me so much to follow my reactivity. And that by dealing with my fear that I was going to be kicked out of here because I was too mouthy and too negative and too whatever, but that didn't happen. People still talk to me and have been fairly respectful towards me, even though I say rude and obnoxious things. And the interesting thing, having gone through all this, is that with fewer and fewer things for me to object to, I've actually dove in with greater eagerness than in years, and taken on different positions, and I'm studying to be a precentor, and it's been a real shift getting through this very angry, defiant stage. And I'm realizing that for a Sangha, it's a challenge for all of these stages. We've got to put up with everybody going through their development, and I'm grateful that many people have been willing to put up with me here in that process as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's when we are in a defiant stage, when we're in a tearing down stage, it feels very real and total. It's, you can't really stand aside and say, oh, look, I'm in a tearing down phase. You're just in a tearing down phase. I would hope that the Sangha is mature enough to really have room for this, as long as we are respectful in our right speech does not have to be nice speech. And it doesn't have to be agreeable speech. Right speech has to be respectful. And you can disagree in a very respectful way, but you can say the Lotus Sutra is a bunch of crap in a very respectful way. The Lotus Sutra is fine. Doesn't bother the Lotus Sutra at all. What it does is it challenges everybody else in the room and yourself. So you just, you know, and right speech is tricky, but there should be room for us to, especially in seminary, which is for seniors, room for disagreement and for coming out of disagreement. So,
well, I will say, having come out of Lotus Sutra, realizing that I needed to practice right speech, my last seminary class was devoted to being more respectful.
Okay, one last comment back there, and then we'll be done.
Thank you for your talk. That was really complex and interesting. Is this working? Okay. So in pairing, when you talked about pairing, what occurred to me at the moment was a pairing of explorer and scribe. And I see that as a pair of and even, you know, the Buddha and those that wrote his lessons, Ananda and others, that, or hundreds of years later. But the purpose of a narrative has always interested me, because it seems at some points in life to have a narrative, whether it's informed by the Jungian, the archetypes, or by psychology or whatever, seems to make sense of what's happened to us, and allows it not to be shameful, and to say, be able to interpret current behaviors by how logical or rational it is that we are at this a particular point in life. But at what, if that's something that you might hold true, at what point does a narrative actually, well, I think it's, how do we know when giving up a narrative or enhancing and needing to enhance a narrative becomes important, because using that as a template for the future is so, could be so misguiding or wrong. So at some point, when, what might be the indications of letting go of what has made sense of one's past? Also, this could be applied to a nation or a family.
I'm not sure I entirely followed that, but let me just say this, that I mean, I think we are story makers. We have to accept the fact that as a species, humans make stories, and each of us makes stories. But I think the difference is that the story should be changing all the time. So I would say that I was this kind of child and my family was this kind of family. And as I've gotten older, that's more nuanced, it's more complex, it's changed. In some ways, it's changed completely. Oh no, I was really this kind of person, or I was both of those kinds of people. It gets more complicated and just more sophisticated, the story, because it encompasses more. So it's not that you have to throw the story away, you just have to investigate the story more deeply and make it fuller.
Is that the need of a child going to the next stage?
I think that's a need for all of us all the time. I still have a story about who I was as a child and what my family was like, but it's much more generous, compassionate, and nuanced than it used to be. And it includes the stories of my parents and their parents instead of fixing them in place. So it's an ongoing, evolving story now, which allows me to be evolving.
Thank you.